With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is the Freeman Report with James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good morning if you're in the UK, good afternoon or good evening if you live elsewhere in the world. It is Thursday, the 2nd of February, 2023. Now, I'm going to start with a precautionary tale. So I went to bed last night thinking about today's show and all of the questions that I would be asking my guests. I've got Hedley Rees, who's a farmer insider, on the show today, along with Matt Letissier. Now, quite often when you go to bed or you go to sleep thinking about something, you end up dreaming about it, and I certainly did. But instead of it being a fantastic dream about talking about all of these interesting topics, it ended up being a recurring nightmare, with me waking up halfway through the show, my alarm hadn't gone off, and the producers were screaming down the phone at me. And this happened again and again last night. So the lesson here is, be very careful about what you think about before you go to sleep. But the good news is, I'm here. My alarm did go off, and we've got another fantastic show for you today. So first up, I've got Hedley Rees. So Hedley is a consultant at PharmaFlow Limited, which specializes in operations and supply chain management in the pharmaceutical industry. Hedley has years of experience and knowledge about manufacturing and supply of pharmaceutical products. So we'll be talking about the failures of the UK medicines regulator, MHRA, in licensing and safety monitoring of the COVID-19 vaccines. Second up, I have Matt Letissier. Now, Matt is obviously a former football player who spent most of his career at Southampton and also won 8 caps for England. Matt has done much work over the last 3 years to push back against government overreach, and also he's done some great work raising awareness of vaccine injuries from the COVID-19 vaccines. Now, I want to talk about many things with Matt, but I want to explore the question of what are the ingredients that mold and motivate people that put their head above the parapet, despite all of the risks. I also want to find out why he started speaking up publicly about the harms of lockdown, and also to learn about some of the work that he's done raising awareness of COVID-19 vaccine injuries. But before we go over to Dee Dee Denslow for one of the big headlines of the day, I want to talk about the World Health Organization again. Now, in addition to this radio show, I also work with the World Council for Health as an international liaison. I'm the guy who connects influential people with each other under the umbrella of the World Council for Health. Now, there are many threats to our freedoms and health at the moment, but I can tell you this, that the biggest immediate threat that hardly anyone is aware of or talking about right now is being negotiated in secret at the World Health Organization. You see, the WHO is attempting a global power grab by seeking to have the 194 member nations of the World Health Assembly adopt amendments to the IHR, that's the International Health Regulations. And they're also negotiating in secret a new pandemic treaty. Now, the proposed amendments would make the WHO's proclamations legally binding rather than just advisory recommendations, which means we would end up with things like permanent global digital health certificates and whatever other policy WHO deems necessary to prevent a future pandemic. It would also dramatically increase the billions of dollars available to the WHO and enable nations to implement the regulations without respect for dignity, human rights, and fundamental freedoms of you and me. Now, the reason I'm talking about this again is that I am part of a global network that will be working on multiple fronts this year to stop this attempted global takeover. So in the next few weeks, you will hear more about this from me as we start to implement our global strategy. Now, for those of you who want to get ahead of the curve, I suggest you visit the Substack of James Rogusky. Read his articles on The Who and what it's up to and share this information. But more importantly, tell everyone you know who is awake about this show. Because what I'm planning to bring in the coming weeks is a global plan to resist this attempted power grab. Right, okay, at TNT Radio, we never go home. We are committed to bringing you our take on the biggest topics of the time. We broadcast live 24/7, on loan globally, no matter what. So make sure you tune in to TNT Radio at tntradio.live. Okay, now stick with me because Dee Dee Denslow will be joining me in a moment. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Stream us wherever you are.
I listen on Alexa.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good morning, Darren. So what's this story about? I hear that the UK Defence Secretary is to investigate the 77th Brigade surveillance of COVID lockdown critics.
Yeah, it looks like Ben Wallace is stuck his head up above the parapet and said he's going to investigate himself. Claims that the British Army's Information Warfare Unit, the 77th Brigade, something that has really sort of been considered a conspiracy for the last 3 years, monitored lockdown critics on social media platforms are being investigated, UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace has said on Monday, in light of a new report from the civil liberties group Big Brother Watch. The UK government admitted that it monitored lockdown critics on social media platforms via its disinformation units during COVID, but denied that it targeted individuals. For its Ministry of Truth report, Big Brother Watch, a Twitter account that everyone should be following, submitted numerous freedom of information requests and cooperated with people in public life who submitted requests to demand copies of their data held by government disinformation units. The report found that the monitoring and reporting of critics were done under the government's counter disinformation unit in the Culture Department, so that's the Digital Culture and Media Department, once ruled over by a certain Mr. Hancock. Big Brother Watch also disclosed a whistleblower testimony, which they claimed confirmed the 77th Brigade collected posts on Twitter from UK citizens posting about COVID-19 and passed them to the government. And one of the people, James, that apparently was being monitored by this military brigade, who Tobias Elwood MP is a very proud member of, was David Davis MP. Now, I'm not sure what David Davis was saying that was so controversial or such a threat to national security with regards to COVID, but he was somebody who apparently, according to Big Brother Watch, was monitored. He has also called for the issue to be reviewed, with Wallace issuing an assurance that he had already instructed for it to be looked into. So, yeah, the 77th Brigade, a rumoured disinformation unit, or they monitor disinformation, but actually my encounters with alleged Twitter accounts and social media accounts belonging to the 77th Brigade found that they were the one pushing the misinformation online, and they were out to cause as much trouble, get people cancelled, silenced, shut down, monitored, recorded. And James, like me and you, we're probably on a list somewhere. And again, these are activities that were carried out probably with the instructions of our own government.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to point out about how ridiculous it is that he's going to investigate this, because, you know, this is an army brigade. Is he kind of suggesting that he didn't know about this? I find that a bit ridiculous. And, you know, when you look at some of the reports that were being given to back to Cabinet Office, which were about individuals. I mean, Tony Hinton was on the show last week and implicated in it. Julia Hartley Brewer as well, who's obviously a UK journalist. So is he really trying to claim that he didn't know this was going on? I mean, that's the first thing to point out. I mean, that is just absolutely ridiculous. No, it doesn't make any sense, because he sits in the cabinet and this is information that was being reported back to the cabinet office. So for him to try and make out that he didn't know about it is just clown world, to be honest with you. Right now, okay, I've learned a little bit about these subject access requests. I am going to do some digging today and find out how you put one in, because anybody can put one of these into the government and they have to tell you about all the information they have on you. So I'm definitely going to put one in for myself. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if I was on some list somewhere, because I was causing a lot of problems for DCMS when Nadine Dorries was Secretary of State there. I even had the UK Statistics Authority write a public letter telling her off for making up statistics. Now, I've also had reports from people within the civil service that I know about a secret unit within DCMS. The staff there come in, they don't talk to all the other staff, nobody knows what they're doing. I'd like to know what they're up to as well. But this is ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, the British Army spying on British citizens who are worried about government policy. I mean, it's just beyond ridiculous. You know, 5 years ago, if you'd heard this story and you weren't told which country it was happening in, you'd have assumed it was in China or maybe even North Korea. Or one of the other countries around the world where this is common. You wouldn't have thought that this would be going on in the United Kingdom. It is worrying how far we've travelled over the last 3 years, but it's equally as good that this is all coming out now. And I think I've invited the head of Big Brother Watch onto the show. I spoke to their office yesterday. So hopefully we'll get Silky on the show in the next week to talk a little bit more about this. Darren, I mean, what do you make of all of this? It's ridiculous, isn't it?
I mean, you just mentioned the subject access data request. I have actually used one. I have an example that I can probably send you that's pretty good. Oh, do employers, public sector organizations not like them? They're very expensive to manage and they have to comply and provide you with all sorts of data. I mean, the Big Brother, is, you know, the British Army's 77th unit is supposed to be used against strategic enemies. It was used against the Taliban. It was used against Al-Qaeda. It's probably used against China, probably used against North Korea. So why they're turning it onto their own citizens during a public health crisis sort of makes no sense and casts a lot of doubt on the validity or the nature of the public health crisis that we've been having to deal with for the last couple of years. And you mentioned other units. The government does have other units. It has a rapid response unit, a counter disinformation unit, a government information cell, and each one of those departments, organizations, wherever they fit into the structure of government, were responsible for monitoring and flagging disinformation content to social media companies. So they already had these departments and stuff in place. Why did they need to use a military-grade psychological operations unit on the British public during a pandemic when many people were probably terrified and frightened and worried about what was going on in the first place? Doesn't really make any sense, and I'm pretty sure Ben Wallace investigating it will turn up very, very little.
Well, two things to say about that. We're obviously all Russian spies, clearly. But, you know, the funny thing is, when you actually look back at the people that they were investigating and what those people were saying, we were right. We were right. They weren't conspiracy nonsense. They weren't disinformation. They weren't misinformation. We were right about lockdown. We were right about the vaccines. And all of this is going to come out. And so it makes it even more ridiculous that the British Army was spying on people who were talking about these things. Right, okay, Darren, thank you for that. We'll Cheers speak to you again in the second hour. Thank you.
Cheers.
Right, okay, now stick with me because after the break, I have Hedley Rees on the line with me. Hedley is a farmer insider, so we will be talking about all things to do with manufacturing of pharmaceutical products. So don't go anywhere. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Jesse Zurawell.
The latest round of proposed amendments to the international health regulations, which were very concerning for many reasons, one of them being the clause about human dignity was canceled out. What is most concerning to you at this point in time?
In simplistic form, the most concerning nature of it is the secrecy behind it. It is still not available on the WHO website. They've submitted their final report on the proposed amendments to the Director General that would have given him a little bit of time to then notify the 194 member nations of the existence of that final report, which is required, according to the international health regulations, a 4-month advanced notice prior to the yearly World Health Assembly. Last year, they kept the document secret until April 12th. And that is just absolutely not acceptable. Where's the damn document?
Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Polio, cholera, autism, measles, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. There's a lot of sicknesses and diseases in the world that cause the death and suffering of millions of people. But what if some of these diseases weren't natural? What if they didn't have to happen? What if some of these diseases were directly caused by humans? I don't know about you, but if there was a disease that was somehow our fault, I'd want to know. I'd feel like there was something I could do about it. Natural diseases are studied at expensive universities with microscopes and petri dishes, lab coats. But what about man-made disease? That's something we can combat. That's something we can stop. This is why I started ICANN. At ICANN, we're dedicated to the eradication of man-made disease. The first step in eradicating an error is admitting that an error has been made. Our medical establishment now claims that this is the first generation of children in America that will not live to be as old as their parents. That is not natural. Something has gone terribly wrong. And today I ask you to join us as we begin an investigation into our food, our air, our water, our drugs, and our vaccines. In an effort to find the cause of this growing epidemic, we are launching a global, no-holds-barred search for man-made disease. Join our newsletter so you can be the first to hear about results from scientific studies we are funding, legal battles we are waging, and media campaigns we are creating. We are the Informed Consent Action Network, and this is our quest.
Your donation is vital to our success. Visit ICANDecide.org. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Every public classroom should have a camera where parents can watch and listen during class. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back with me, James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio. It is Thursday, the 2nd of February, 2023. And on the line, I have Hedley Rees. So Hedley is a consultant at PharmaFlow Limited, which specializes in the operations and supply chain management in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, I have spoken to Hedley before. I've interviewed him, and he has years of experience and knowledge about manufacturing and supply of pharmaceutical products. Hello, Hedley.
Hi, James. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good this morning. I didn't get much sleep because I had a recurring nightmare that I woke up halfway through the show. My alarm hadn't gone off, but it was just a dream and I'm here. So thank goodness for that. Right now, Hedley, before we get into the detail, I think it's probably worth you just quickly sort of giving an overview of your background and why you're qualified to talk about all of the stuff we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, sure, James. Yeah, so I spent 16 years at Bayer in the UK, Bayer Manufacturing, from 1980. So that's how old I am. So I picked up all the skills of procurement, production planning, logistics, and the good distribution practices, good manufacturing practices, all the good practices that have to be applied in the industry. I did an executive MBA at Cranfield in 1994-95, then left Bayer to join British Biotech and spent another 10 years in biotech. Biotech basically outsources all of its manufacture and supply, so the skill sets there are about working with contractors to bring products to market. And since 2005, I've been an independent consultant working with drug developers, especially the virtual small drug developers, in bringing drugs to market. I've history of bringing numbers of drugs from preclinical through all the phases of clinical trials through to market launch and ongoing supply. In 2011, Wiley asked me to write a book on supply chain management, and that published in 2011. That was a 450-page textbook. I had 30 expert contributors to it, and it sold in 35 countries. The royalties you get aren't massive, but it got the word out there. But the industry has been ignoring me ever since because I was very critical of the way the industry manufactures and develops its products. So that's me.
Brilliant. And so basically, you're more than qualified to talk about all the things we're going to talk about today, Hedley. And obviously, you live just down the road with me in rainy Wales as well, don't you?
Oh, tell me about it. Yeah, it is rainy Wales today. But yeah, I'm a passionate Welshman, and it's my big ambition is to see Wales punch its weight in the world of life sciences. So,
yeah. Amen to that. Now, I think before we start talking about things in detail, I think it's worth just laying out a little bit of context here in the UK. You mentioned life sciences there. Hedley, I wonder if you could just spend 2 to 3 minutes just kind of laying out what life sciences are and how the UK has positioned itself and, you know, and the investments it's made in the life sciences.
Yeah, well, life sciences in the commercial world is basically pharmaceuticals, diagnostics and medical devices and companies who supply those sectors. So it's not the sort of pure science. It's a very applied science. And in obviously, the pharmaceutical industry is the most profitable industry in the world. So in 2009, the UK government set up the Office for Life Sciences to basically bring the UK into number one position in the world of life sciences. And in 2011, the government, it was then a coalition government, published Strategy for Life Sciences. So I'm just going to check out my... it here. So this is, as I say, it's 2011. It was basically sponsored by then Sir Andrew Lansley, who was Secretary of State for Health, and David Willetts, who was Minister of State for Universities and Science. And I'm going to just read out some of the key actions in that report. And remember, this is going back to 2011. Early in 2012, the MHRA would bring forward for consultation proposals for a new early access scheme to increase the speed and efficiency of routes to market approvals for innovative breakthrough therapies. Now, it's turned out those therapies are fundamentally gene therapies. Through the MHRA, we will work with industry and other international regulators to develop actions which will create a more enabling regulatory environment for the adoption of innovative manufacturing technology. We will do this by the second quarter of 2012. And the real interesting one here is they say they're going to make the UK the go-to place for experimental medicine. Now, experimental medicine, well, you know, okay, that was an aspiration, but there's more to medicine than experiments. If you can't develop medicines and manufacture medicines, then you haven't got a medicine. And I was part of this because in 2013, I was asked by the Office for Life Sciences to find a company that would apply for a grant, a UK government grant called the Advanced Manufacturing Supply Chain Initiative. The two previous rounds, no life science company had managed to get an award. And obviously, because I had a background in innovation and forward thinking in the industry and had written the book, I was asked to find a company. So I went along to the launch meeting for round three. And Michael Fallon did the initial sort of speech. And on the table I was sat on was the chair of Oxford Biomedica, a company based in Oxford, and had actually worked at that site previously. So to cut a long tale short, I was asked to go along, and I consulted to them over 6 months on this grant, and it was a successful grant, £7.1 million they had. At the time, they were making a gene therapy for Novartis, which eventually became a product called Kymria, which launched in 2017 in the US. FDA approved it August 2017. And it has some horrible side effects. It's for blood cancer, but it's around $475,000 a treatment when it first launched. So it's not cheap by any measure. But the government and all the stakeholders in NHS and all these different bodies, they're all following these CAR T therapies like mad. There's three networks set up in the UK, all trying to make it work, but it's impossible to make them work. These therapies are specific to each individual patient. The patients in the hospital and the manufacturing plant could be 300-400 miles away. Everything's got to be kept cold chain, cryogenically stored. The cells from the patients are cryogenically stored and transported. It's an absolute logistics nightmare, and yet they're still trying to make it work. So I've been horrified.
Yeah, I think, Hedley, if I can just stop you there, because we will talk about some of that detail in a minute. But I think the point I wanted to get across is it's safe to say that the UK government has placed a big bet and an awful lot of money on life sciences. So after the break, we'll talk about, I want to start off by talking about what it is and the process for bringing pharmaceuticals to market and what's happened with these COVID-19 vaccines. So we're going to take a quick break for the news headlines now, but don't go away because we'll pick up where we left off after this short break.
And here's the news. Extra. TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Israel's new conservative government has been accused of deepening discriminatory policies towards the Palestinian population. South Africa is considering declaring a national state of disaster as it struggles to cope with an acute energy crisis. It comes as the West forces its green agenda on the country. And Ukraine has accused Twitter owner Elon Musk of sympathizing with Russia and deliberately reducing the reach of Kyiv's accounts on the social media site.
Don't miss a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. Available right now to download. Keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Freeman Report with me, James Freeman. On the line, I've got Hedley Rees, who's got years and years of experience in terms of manufacturing and supply chains in the pharmaceutical industry. Now, before the break, we were talking about the fact that the UK has invested an awful lot in the life sciences. And, you know, that will influence MPs who are being lobbied a lot by these big companies. Now, Hedley, I think most people now by this point have heard about the fact that it normally takes 5 to 10 years to bring some of these pharmaceutical products to market. So we don't need to sort of labor that and go over that. But there are some really interesting kind of things about the process and how it happens, and then contrasting that with what's happened with the COVID-19 vaccines, because this isn't just about the length of time. It's about the fact that they've done things that should happen in a sequential order. And there's good reasons why they happen in that order, because the following sequence is dependent about what happens in the first sequence. And they haven't done any of that. They've done it all, you know, at the same time. And that means that they have missed big, big chunks of what has been built up in terms of safety regulation. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that for me, Hedley.
Yeah, sure, James. So a development candidate, when a molecule is selected to go into development, is called a new molecular entity. It could be either what they call a small molecule product or biologic. Small molecules are fairly, you know, relatively simple to work with. They've been around a long time. Biologics are a very different kettle of fish. So, but for any new molecular entity, you have to first, it's an unknown substance, so you first have to prove it's safe for humans. And to do that, you have to make a small quantity, maybe 10 kilos, 10 liters, and you then have to test that in animal models. And we'd like not to be testing in animals, but it's the only safe way for humans at the moment. And that quantity has to be manufactured. So supplies of raw materials and the intermediates have to be sourced. They have to be then converted into finished product and the active ingredient. That then has to be shipped to a contract research organization that specializes in animal testing. And they're heavily regulated with good laboratory practice. And they do the tests and they report on the tests. And there's all sorts of tests that have to take place on toxicology, immunogenicity, and all these things. And it typically takes 3 years for the preclinical testing to be carried out. And that's been confirmed by the US Government Accountability Office in 2006. If it's proven safe, then it goes into clinic in testing in humans. Phase one is a safety test in healthy volunteers. Those healthy volunteers have to be dosed up, and they, again, reports are written. They house the volunteers in very nice places with Game Boys and all these sorts of things. And that phase two study, probably they'd have to make another 50 kilos of active ingredient to be able to produce the drug for the trials. Also, they have to create the dosage form, be it capsules or, and we know for the injections, the dosage form was a vial for injection. And again, when you make that larger quantity, you have to test that in animal models again, because when you go from one scale to another, you can change the composition of a molecule. That's very well known throughout the whole industry. And as you get towards larger studies, phase 2B and phase 3, you have to scale up again. And maybe at 100 kilos liter, 200 liters, and you have to do the safety testing again before it goes into that goes into patients. So what they did with the vaccines was to do what they called a roll and reveal, where they just did all the three phases all together. So none of that scale-up testing for safety could have taken place. So you can guarantee these injections were going to be toxic. You know, maybe not every part of it, because it depends, you know, some of it may have passed testing, who knows. But so that's why these are done in series. You know, there's a reason why for 60 years, phase one, phase two, phase three studies, and then the phase four studies are actually studies in the market when the product's marketed, but those don't happen at all these days. You know, so the standards have been crashed. So I hope that helps, James. Is that?
Yeah, no, it does. I think you described it really, really well. Obviously, we've spoken before, so I do understand a little bit about that. I think you described that in brilliant detail. Now, another thing to, I think, point out, which we've spoken about before, is the role of regulators. Now, normally, you know, every time all of these manufacturing sites, they would actually have on-site investigations, wouldn't they, where people go there and they spend however many days testing everything, looking at processes, speaking to the staff, etc. What's happened with that? Tell us about a little bit about that over the this period, over the last 3 years with these COVID-19 vaccines.
Well, I think it's all been virtual inspections, and MHRA actually wrote a paper that was looking at using virtual inspections in the longer term. Now, a virtual inspection is as useful as a chocolate teapot, isn't it? Because, you know, would you buy a house if someone said, I'll get a camera, I'll go around the house and show you the bits I want you to see, and then you can buy it? You know, it's a joke. But the only regulator that's actually done inspections is the US FDA, and they've had some absolutely horrific results. A company in Germany that's making the Pfizer drug substance, Rentschler, they had an absolutely scathing inspection by FDA, and the inspection would be two inspectors fully experienced in the site for 4 days, and they were basically saying, it's completely out of control, no quality system, you know, almost every process was just guesswork. Same with a company called Catalent Pharma Solutions in Bloomington in the US. They do the fill finish for the Moderna vaccine. And again, that was a complete train crash, you know, and they've been allowed to go on processing. And this has been published in Fierce Pharma, very well known publication in the industry. The results of these these inspections, and even in the FDA, you get what they call a form 483, which they document everything that they found. They're appalling. So these inspections just have not taken place, and it's a scandal, absolute scandal.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, there's reasons why they take place, these on-site reports and investigations, is because it's complicated, isn't it? For Hedley, you know, this isn't just about, you know, you're not just making regular stuff. You're talking about ingredients that need to be kept at certain temperatures. You've quite often got the manufacturing is happening across multiple sites. So ingredients need to be, delivered between sites at certain temperatures. This is complicated stuff, isn't it, Hedley?
Yeah, well, people who work in other industry sectors would know about lead times and, you know, supply agreements and technical and quality agreements, where the company selling the drug has to tell all its manufacturers how to make it. You know, the timelines just didn't allow any of that work to be done. So, you know, if you walked into an automotive plant, you'd instantly know it was complicated. But how many people have actually been into a plant or seen on TV a plant that manufactured pharmaceutical products? You know, it's all smoke and mirrors. And they're all contractors, you know. None of them have got skin in the game other than pay for performance, sort of.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of evidence that these mRNA products are harming people. But there's also, you know, that's when I think the assumption is that they are doing what they're supposed to do, i.e., you know, we're making mRNA products, and yes, they're harming people, but they're doing what they're intended to do in terms of the design and specification. But, you know, when you look at all these problems with the manufacturing processes, we do know that there have been lots of injuries that have been clustered around certain batches of the vaccines in terms of manufacturing. Tell us a little bit about that, Hedley.
Well, we know from Sasha Latipova, who's done a lot of work on the original toxic batches. They were made, the first 33 batches were made not following good manufacturing and good distribution practice. They were made by a site that was an R&D site, the Pfizer R&D site in Andover in the US. And we know for sure they were called emergency batches. They were actually using the batches that normally you'd use as the last stage of testing before you go to the batches that you're going to supply commercially. They used those batches, which were always going to be of incredibly questionable quality. And we know from leaked documents, you know, we know that. And still, even in the light of all the information, you know, the people know those batch numbers. People who've been injured have looked up the batch numbers in the US VAERS system, the Vaccine Adverse Event System. So they know what batches actually harm them. And what must that be like? You know, it's unbelievable. So there's two things. The evidence in the analysis is showing these batches were toxic, but also how they were manufactured guaranteed they were going to be toxic.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, there are cases. I think there were 120 Vietnamese children who ended up in hospital because of a faulty batch. And also there were batches in Japan that were withdrawn because they found metal in them. Right, okay. Now we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Hedley, I want to talk about this on-site manufacturing, because there is a part of the manufacturing process that actually happens on-site at the vaccination centres. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So don't go away. We'll be straight back after this short break.
Private jet flying John Kerry, the climate envoy for the United States, gets confronted in Davos about his private jet misadventures.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Kudos to the Rebel News for running down the big celebrities in Davos. One of them was Secretary John Kerry. Here's what he had to say about his private jet ways.
How can you justify being here when you yourself take private jets? Can you answer that? But you've taken a private jet before. No, but you've taken a private jet before to collect a climate change award. You have done that.
So climate envoy John Kerry now claims to fly commercially exclusively? I think this is the equivalent of asking a 4-pack-a-day cigarette smoker, hey, how many packs do you smoke? And their answer is, I quit completely. And it sounds plausible until you realize they quit yesterday. The question is John Kerry going to continue flying private jets? One set of rules for thee, another set for them. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Here's a fun fact for you. The average chameleon can point their eyes in two different directions. On the other hand, the average human can't. So unless you're a chameleon, there's absolutely no way you can focus on texting and driving at the same time. So don't do it, unless you're a chameleon.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Caution. You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country is all about.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Freeman Report with me, James Freeman. On the line, I have Hedley Reese, who's a farmer insider. Now, before the break, we were talking about all of the things which didn't happen, which should have happened in terms of manufacturing safe pharmaceutical products. But there is a part of the manufacturing process, actually, that happens not in the factory, but it actually happens at the end site, so the vaccination centres. Tell us a little bit about this, Hedley.
Well, the main advanced therapies are these CAR T therapies for blood cancer, and they are specific to the patient. So the patient is in the hospital, their cells are extracted, the T cells are extracted, they're sent off to be manufactured, which means there's a genetic adjustment to their cells that is going to help them. And then those are sent back to the site, and then the site have to administer the cells back into the patient. Now, typically with any medicinal products, and these gene therapies, etc., are called advanced therapy medicinal products, only the doctor only ever gets a fully finished manufactured product. So if it was an injection, they would either get the vial in their hands and the syringe, and then they just throw out the quantity and administer that to the patient, or it would be a pre-filled syringe. So No doctor has ever had to get involved in converting the product from one stage to another. What's happened now is that MHRA have changed regulations this year so that hospital pharmacies can actually carry out the finishing operations. And if we take the frozen gene therapies that Pfizer and Moderna supplied, that would mean they'd have to thaw the frozen vaccine, which in itself is a manufacturing operation, and it should be done under controlled conditions. It should be studied first to see the conditions that you've got to thaw under to make sure that what was frozen to minus 70 degrees C, when it gets to room temperature or plus 228 refrigerated, there's been, again, no change in the molecular structure. And after those studies, then you say, when you thaw it, you have to do it this way. You write the standard operating procedure, and then the people doing it have to sign that they've been trained in that operating procedure. The regulations have now been changed, and I've been speaking to Ian Rees, who's the head of innovation and strategy at MHRA, about a freedom of information request. I've had a Teams call with him, and I'm still in email dialogue with him, asking to explain how can this happen. And all I've been told so far, the MHRA won't be responsible for this. The Care Quality Commission will be responsible. So, you know, as someone told them off they are, how, where are they going to get the knowledge, experience and skills? I still haven't had an answer to that. Ian Rees has promised me an answer, and I'm still waiting for it, because MHRA has to approve the product and the supply chain from start to finish to the point where it's administered to the patient. And if anything happens before that point, it has to be carefully regulated. So what I've asked is, how are you going to license the product if you don't know what's going to happen to it in the final stages? You know, so they have contravened yeah. their own licensing process.
And this was going on, wasn't it, in car parks and leisure centres where we had vaccination centres. Essentially, there were people there. I mean, this is supposed to be, first thing we should point out is this sort of post-manufacturing processes are supposed to be carried out by licensed premises, aren't they? But this was going on in vaccination centres, and they were thawing them on site. And then also, you know, I think, Hedley, we've talked about this in the past, they come in sort of five-shot vials. So then the vials need to be separated so that you then end up with the final doses to give people. So these are very, very important parts of the process. And essentially, they can be very, very dangerous if not done correctly. And this was going on in vaccination centres across the UK, wasn't it, Hedley?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, no quality control prior to the receipt of the frozen vaccines and the administration to the patient. And you can imagine, you know, if I'd been put in a vaccination center, I wouldn't really know what to do, because the instructions were on the internet, so you'd have to find them on the internet first. Now, typically, if I was an operator there, I would have been part of the quality system. I would have, you know, been uniquely identified. My training record would be there. And, you know, I'd have signed that I'm happy with the SOP, the standard operating procedure, and all those things. And it is actually stunningly unbelievable that this was happening. And if I go back to these CAR T therapies, this is the main a thrust of gene therapies going forward, and it's still happening, even though, you know, the truth on the injections is coming out. The UK government still has a plan to become number one in the world in life sciences via these what advanced therapies, which are mainly the gene therapies, the CAR T therapies, which are hugely expensive. The healthcare system can't afford them anyway. You know, Novartis have got one, which I think they've said it was going to cost $3 million a treatment, and I think they knocked it down to, you know, $1.5 million or whatever. These are eye-watering numbers that no healthcare system is ever going to be able to afford.
Right now, I think we can wrap this up by saying clearly they're working at the speed of science, aren't they? Now, so far, we've been talking about sort of the licensing and manufacturing, but also the other role of the MHRA as the medicines regulator is actually to monitor safety once these products are out there in the wild. And I'd like to talk a little bit about, I think, some of the failures of MHRA. Now, Hedley, AstraZeneca, what happened with AstraZeneca?
Well, AstraZeneca didn't develop or manufacture the injections. Oxford University probably sent some code, some genetic code along to Oxford Biomedica, the company I mentioned earlier, which is a contract manufacturer. I spent six or more months there. Nice, lovely people, skilled, but, you know, these gene therapies are still early stage, immature, experimental. The supply chains are riddled with potential problems and issues. And so that's the first thing. People don't realize that the company selling these injections didn't actually make them and had very little control of what was going on in the supply chain. We know that the Kymria product that Oxford Biomedica supplied to Novartis has got two, everyone gets side effects. The two main side effects are neurological toxicities and a cytokine release syndrome, effectively sepsis. And, you know, you don't have to be a genius to work out that those aren't too dissimilar to the adverse events that we've been seeing with the injections. So there is a big question mark over the safety, the principle of these injections. When you put an unknown substance into your body, no one knows what the body's going to do to the substance and what the substance is going to do to the body. You know, you have to study and, you know, study safety and find safe ways of learning how the drug works. You cannot say, oh, my theory is if we put mRNA vaccines in, it's going to create this spike protein, that's going to do this, and then, oh gosh, we're going to cure, you know, we're going to create a vaccine. That's impossible. It's the hard yards of actually building an evidence on evidence on evidence that this drug actually, it happened with penicillin. Penicillin was an accidental finding initially, but then it took Oxford University and the US Department of Agriculture to actually build all the evidence that it was effective and safe and could be manufactured at scale.
Yeah, and exactly. And this is why it normally takes 5 to 10 years, isn't it, Hedley? Because in order to do these things and produce these products, you know, it's not just a figure we've pulled out of thin air that we can just compress into, what, a few months. There's good reason why it takes 5 to 10 years. Right now, Hedley, you publish an awful lot of information online. Tell everybody where they can find some of the stuff that in articles that you write.
Yeah, well, I've got a Substack called Inside Pharma. It's been free for 12 months. So I've built basically an evidence base, and some of the subscribers have told me. This would all stand up in a court of law, and you know, I testify to everything that's in there. I have converted it to paid now at $5 a month to allow me that there's so much work I'm having to do now to keep putting this out that but there's that. I've written Taming the Big Pharma Monster by Speaking Truth to Power. Find It, File It, Flog It, which are all about Big Pharma's gambling addiction that they've had for the last 40 years, which has in fact resulted in what we have today. You know, the industry is emaciated. They've outsourced almost all their physical belongings. It's still very profitable, but, you know, the trajectory is right down into the gutter. And so, if you do a search engine on Hedley Reese, you'll find the various articles. You know, a lot of stuff will come up, and I'm still going around, you know, speaking to people like you, James, who've got a big following, and you know, who can get the message out. And I'm so grateful that you're doing this.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Hedley. Right, you've got about a minute left, so you need to keep it brief. But what do you want to happen now going forward?
I want to see an inquiry into the current patent laws, because patents create monopolies. It wasn't like this 40 years ago. You had to patent the process to manufacture, not a molecule, with a harebrained explanation of how it could work in a disease. There have been 30 failures in Alzheimer's in the last 15 years, all on some theory that's been proven not to work. So, and Jeremy Hunt MP has got my white paper. He's also got my request for inquiry. And I think we need that inquiry.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show to share all of your expert and knowledge and opinion today, Hedley. Thank you very much. Right, okay. So after the break, I have got Matt Letissier. So Matt doesn't need any formal introduction, and I'm really, really keen to explore what the ingredients are that mold and motivate people to put their head above the parapet despite all of the risks. So don't go anywhere. Stay with me, James Freeman, on the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.